Good morning once again. We reconvene for the culmination of the Seer Faith Conference. Noel Chair should be in this chair, as you know. I always look forward to the panel because I think it can bring together the themes. I always look forward to it because I can just sit on the back row. And, but when there was a need for someone to step in, I said I think I could do it. I said I would enjoy doing it, but let's see. It really is a great privilege to have these four who I think you'll agree have brought the theme together in various ways. But just to recap a moment, that Lloyd took us on a historical journey, starting with the Reformation of the Church and ending with the reformulation of faith. So he took us from the institution to its issues of authority and orthodoxy towards a humanistic faith. You can disagree with this if I sum it up wrong, okay? Rachel traced the call to reform in many faiths, and the nailing of the theses may be a fictional event, but the reality is the many reformations that there are to ponder. Two Jewish reformations, Muslim reformation and Buddhist reformation. Sue, we only met once before in Hastings when you came to give a talk there. Making it real, beyond Reformation to transformation. Sue reminded us of the three key ways of creating change, either from outside the system or the long march inside the institutions or building our own organisations inside a rotten system. Yes. And Kira. Hal is no less real than Sue, but within a different sphere. If he admitted the things that Sue has admitted to us, then he would not be allowed back in the United States. It's truth, plain fact. And instead, he took us on a wonderful journey, reforming towards beautiful, less arrogant and decentered Christianities. So you will notice that each of our panel has, in their way, subverted the very carefully honed title that we spent endless meetings and endless Skype meetings, Reformation 2.0, we're hip. But that's fine, because that was the starting point. So what we have are questions from yourselves, but I'd like to start where, in a sense, the committee started with the Reformation. We'll just deconstruct it again briefly, and then we'll go on to questions that are more particularly directed to each of you. So these first three questions are actually quite general questions, and it would be good to, this is the point really, to hear a comparative response to all of them. So just taking for a moment the fact that Protestant Reformation has some importance in the history of the Western world, the question is, does the Western world essentially emerge out of the Protestant Reformation?
Yes.
I thought it would be an easy answer for you.
Certainly. I see the modern secular world as the logical development of what took place at the Reformation, in that the Reformation spelled the end of an authoritative institution which directed how we should live. Step by step, that has disintegrated, and through the period of the Enlightenment, which was a natural consequence in many ways, in which people at last felt free to think for themselves. And in thinking for themselves, they were able to establish what was for them the right ways of living, and indeed to come to terms with the physical world in which they live. And in the course of this, the whole spiritual overworld, which existed only in human imagination, has slowly disintegrated, so that the secular world is the logical consequence of that, in which we have to take responsibility for our own lives and make the choices which will be for our own fulfillment and that of other people.
Thank you, Lloyd. So, for the other three of you, feel free to, you know, to answer that in the way you wish.
Yes, I'd like to heartily agree with Lloyd on that, and also state that when Luther talked about the two kingdoms, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of the secular world, he was laying the foundation for what would become secular societies with religion within them, but not governed by the kingdom that was truly God's, and which individuals could relate to in their own ways. But let me just put this one step further. If we're going to talk about Luther, then let me talk about another legendary or significant figure, and that's Alexis de Tocqueville, who went to America. And what he discovered when he went from France to America was an astonishing quality in American society, and that was voluntarism, the voluntary organization of people who put themselves forward in their societies, in their communities. This, I think, is one of the strengths of the Western world, and it has allowed a number of creative individuals, as well as just ordinary folk in their community, to take things into their own hands, to do the sorts of things that Sue actually represents. And I believe that is an outflow of the Reformation. It's perhaps what some people have called an unintended consequence. I think it's a pretty, if I were Luther, I would have hoped for such a consequence. And I think that is what gives this organization, the Sea of Faith, its roots as well, the voluntary, the freedom to come together in these organizations and create something meaningful.
Kia ora, I dare not add much to this, this not being my zone, but just to say yes, of course, but that I also think that the rebels and the self-forming organisations came long before the Martin Luther, including Jesus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was quoting Jesus.
I think that I'm suspicious of a bunch of Protestants congratulating themselves. And so I would raise just a couple of questions, I think. And I think they come primarily, frankly, from conversation over the last two generations with my younger cohorts. That is, I'm not hearing any resounding support for secularism in the people under 40. I'm hearing tons of anxiety. I'm hearing a loss of communitarianism and a loss of symbol sets that might guide them. I think a first question then is, what if the secular is not an end that is attractive for everyone? So, in other words, if we can think about those of us who are aged and hear the younger folks' version of how secularism is working out, I have to pay attention to their deep disease with it. I'm wary of my own anti-Catholicism, and I'm aware, again, this is kind of a view from underneath, so I think I worked for a Catholic university as a professor for some time, owned by an order of nuns. And so actually my primary experience of Catholicism in the United States are the 937 orders of nuns. I actually think of them more as a Catholic presence that is stunningly creative than Protestantism. Thank you.
So thank you for bringing us up to date, Hal, because that was the point. We're not going to stay in the past, and it's quite interesting. Actually, 50 years ago, it was interesting how Martin Luther was picked up by the East German state, celebrated as the workers' hero. We all interpret, remake the legends, and you're probably familiar with that famous picture of Jesus as Che Guevara. We're always, in a rabbinical way, recycling our heroes. The point of the title, and this is the last time I will nag at this bone, Reformation 2.0, is there any sense in which we are in the midst of a second Reformation comparable to the Protestant Revolution? Or maybe we're in a third Jewish one? By their very nature, are they always in flux? So the question is, are we in a particular time when which we could call a second Reformation of the same ilk?
I'm not sure I would have to be able to call it a Reformation. We are certainly in a process of radical cultural change, and as I said earlier, I see it as the consequence of the Protestant Reformation. But should it be called a Reformation? I'm not sure about that, whether it's a very appropriate term. What I see is that we are moving into a period in which nationalism is becoming obsolete. Particular religions are going to become less dominant than they were before. There is forming a new global consciousness of humankind in which we recognize our commonality above all the earlier divisions. And the rise of the United Nations is a good example of that. The Declaration of Human Rights has now become the creed of this new global humanity. And whether you call that a reformation or not, I'm not sure, but I see it as a direct result of all that happened at the Reformation.
So no obligation to stay with the word Reformation, but are we in that particular kind of change? We could even develop the question, what are the if we are in such a particular time of change, what are the drivers of that transformation today in politics or in religion? And can each inform the other in politics and religion?
Well, that's a really big question, but I would have to say that I'm sorry to disagree with Lloyd. I see the United Nations as a very vulnerable and failing organization that is about to fall, and I would be the first to cheer it to fall because it needs to be replaced by something far more representative and equitable. I also see that the UNHDR has been replaced in many, many countries around the world by the Cairo Declaration, which is an Islamic version of human rights that is obedient to Sharia law. So I'm afraid that I see those very valiant and important achievements at their tail end now. I would see, however, the changes taking place being driven by gigantic conflicts in Islam, which are dragging in the rest of the world because we all think we can solve it in some way or another. And that is going to affect us. It's already affecting us enormously. Technological change is enabling a kind of globalization, but a very worrying kind, as well as perhaps a positive end to it. I mean, obviously, we love to be able to be in touch with communities around the world that are like-minded, but at the same time, we're also seeing extremely dangerous and hostile and hate-filled sites making connections around the world. And indeed, that's how we end up with people in Australia waving the black flag and killing innocent people. So we have problems. The kind of movements that are occurring worldwide are generating fear. I think that this will result in some highly defensive measures and people going back to concepts of nationalism and strong borders, which one can easily understand in some cases. It's certainly occurring in Europe right now, where nationalisms are on the rise and even some very old hatreds have reemerged. So I see this period of danger and flux. And listening to Hal and even to Sue as well, I feel that they represent possibly some hopeful directions where people are coming together and finding community who had formerly felt that they were excluded. But I'm afraid I do not see anything very solid. And most certainly, I would have to mention finally that the Royal Commission which is now wrapping up in Australia, that took 5 years, into sexual abuse of children in institutions that very much targeted the churches as well as many other religious organizations and denominations and non-religious organizations. This has literally pulled the rug under many, many people who still had some faith in their church but have now literally walked away from it, and one can certainly understand why. So these, I think, are the big ructions, and we don't know what will emerge from out of it.
From outside the church world, it doesn't look like any reformation or anything like it. Just, I think, your talk yesterday, the splintering and syncretism, which I think is really exciting, the bringing together of understandings and faiths and learning from each other's faiths and from science, which, of course, Reformation opened up. I think that's wonderful. And listening to you this morning as well, the democratisation and vulnerable, I just loved what you said, especially about Leonard Cohen, because I see him as, he's my hero as a theologian, I have to say. Just beautiful to hear a real theologian say that. So it doesn't look like any kind of reformation, and the dangers of going back to fundamentalism, I think everyone in this room knows really well. But I think there's hope, which we badly need, and across the secular and church or faith worlds, it's in our hands to build that hope and the stories of hope and the visions of a better future, especially in the face of acceleration of deep inequality, economic inequality in our own country and around the world, and in the face of the power of transnational capital, and in the face of climate change and resource depletion. And for younger people and our descendants, this is, of course, the huge existential issue that is we can avoid to some extent, but they can't, just as our brothers and sisters in the Pacific can't and elsewhere. And how we, in whichever communities we come from, how we face that. And there is almost an obligation on us to change or improve what we're doing that makes it relevant to younger people, right down to our babies, and to build that hope again. And I think we can, but it's in our hands.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Adrian, for you and your committee as you've posed this question. I do like the concept of reformation, but as not a global process. But I think it, whereas I think that, Lloyd, you are exactly right, that there are signs of the human species acknowledging each other and becoming some kind of unit eventually. I just don't think that it's very close at hand. And I myself find myself wanting to think about a reformation that is just from particular locations of societies or several societies. In other words, it just seems to me that global power right now can only be destructive. And so that I would like to stay with your question about a reformation, not of the world. I think we can't trust the world that much right now. I do think that really significant reformations of consciousness in the human species has to happen on less than global grounds. I just want to also, we haven't talked about this, Sue, but you had in your talk a really important contrast between revolution and reformation. And I want to address that partly because I think the first half of my life was seen totally through the revolutionary frame of reference. My generation, especially in the United States, is known for its hubris in thinking that it had a revolution that was going to change everything. I'm not pessimistic. I'm just noticing that my generation that wanted to be revolutionaries turned out to be relatively selfish. And so as much as I want to be a revolutionary, for now, I find myself thinking that the human strategy that's most helpful is a strategy of located formations.
Okay, thank you. Oh, Lloyd wants to add something to that.
Okay, I'll just respond because I agree essentially with Rachel and Zed. The 21st century is going to be a severe testing time for the whole human race, and it is not at all certain that we'll be here in 100 years because of that. unless we can work together in the way that I suggested, I hope we would, unless we can do that and also deal with the problem of climate change, there is no future for the human race after the end of this century.
Thank you for giving us that context. So those are the general questions, and it's good if we can pick up on some of the things individually that our speakers gave us, and each of the speakers might like to comment on them, but these questions are going to be directed more individually. No Sea of Faith conference would be complete without someone at the AGM saying, we must change the name of Sea of Faith because it doesn't make sense. That's what we do every time. But what we do, under the title Sea of Faith, we have three themes, and I don't know how frequently they change, but they're not always the same three themes, I notice, but the ones that come up more often are values, spirituality, and meaning. Sea of Faith is a discussion network for discussion of values and spirituality and meaning. And I think our questions fit under those titles. So if you fall asleep, which you won't, but and you woke up and you want to know where you are, those are the next three sections. Very Methodist, isn't it? Three sections. Values, spirituality, and meaning. So the most obvious question, I think, Lloyd, was because I think it's what made me wake up. No. What made me sit up during your talk was when you said, our values choose us. In the light of that, is there any mileage in teaching values? There was a question about values education. Values are important, but if our values choose us, maybe it was an off-the-cuff comment. We'd like you to expand on that a little bit, what you meant by that.
Well, what I was meaning was that we don't think about life and then look to see what is of value. Things like justice and love and compassion and truth are values which make a claim upon us. That is, in a sense, they are God for us. They call us to respond. We didn't create them. They have come out of our own human experience. And what we have learned in our own cultural background, where we absorb these from an early, well, of course, our parents, of course, passed them on to us in the first place, our parents and our teachers, but they transcend us so that we don't actually create them. What we do in discussion is learn how to respond to them and respond to them in the best possible way. I'm not sure if that helps to explain it or not.
Does anyone want to comment on that? You have your own values question, but anything sparked off? So, Rachel, your particular question, because you've got that overview of religious movements, but I think even beyond that, the question was are secular and humanist groups subject in the same way to particular times of transformation and reformation? Are the step changes for secular and humanist groups when the values may change?
Well, secular groups and humanist groups respond to the world that they are in, the environment, the trends, the activities, the catastrophes that they are in. And I would imagine that secular groups address themselves to issues that are pressing, whether it's a depression, whether it's the situation that we read about in the climate, whether it's climate change or climate warming, whether it's how to respond to particular groups in their midst. I presume that seculars are challenged by these things and perhaps even challenged by claims amongst religious groups that they experience something of enormous value. If seculars do not address themselves to religion, then I think they are becoming incredibly sectarian and isolated. So what I would like to see, I don't think I will, is someone like Richard Dawkins actually responding genuinely to the realities of religious faith and not reducing them to straw dogs and basically insults. I would hope, and let me just give you another example. There are Jewish humanist groups, and a friend of mine's grandson is just having a bar mitzvah in a Jewish humanist group. And what does that mean? Well, they have created and adopted rituals, obviously, from the Jewish tradition. And what they are doing is being Jewish, except without God, because they are avowed atheists. And what do I see there? I see people acting religiously in some ways, having all of the accoutrements of the Jewish tradition, but just not the concept of God. And actually, when you ask them about God, they come up with some very postmodern philosophical, metaphysical statements. So they're on the move too. I think all groups are on the move as they respond to the realities of human life. And nothing, as I said at the end of my talk, religion is here to stay, but it doesn't stay put. And I think the same is true about secular and humanist groups.
So we think of human rights as coming out of the Enlightenment and as a core value of the Enlightenment. You've shown your passion in particular for employment. I was wondering if this is a little bit of a futurist question again. How will wealth be distributed when most jobs disappear, as we have recently been told will happen? You might want to explore that in different ways.
Yeah, this is a big topic. I mean, something we work in a lot. For a start, I mean, there's a lot of arguments, and always have been, about whether work actually will disappear, because having spent much of my life in working with unemployed people in quite a deep way at times, actually, when you talk to anyone, there is always work that is valuable that they could be doing or are doing in their lives, often unpaid. So there's the whole question about the value of unpaid work, of caring work, of work in the community, on the marae, in your community organisations and so on, and how the value of unpaid versus paid work is a big question in there. But also, there's always lots of work that needs doing, ecologically, socially, in every way. There's no end of work. It's the resourcing and managing of people to enable them to do that work, the training and education that enables them to get into the work they want to do. And I've never ever spent time talking with an unemployed person and not in the end found that there are a thing or things in their lives that they would like to express through work, but the opportunity to do that is so often denied them in a society which doesn't have the right to a decent job or decent training and education, which we don't, and on top of that, no right to an income that we can live on. So these go right to very fundamental values and beliefs about whether we do have a right to engage fully in society, including through work, paid and unpaid, and to be supported in valuable unpaid work, to have that option as well, including caring for our own babies and children. So looking to the future, there are lots, it's very fashionable these days to say that robots are going to take our jobs, algorithms are going to take our jobs, and of course they already are being taken by all sorts of things in that area, but many new jobs are created, and it's always going to be that way, I think, that there isn't a shortage of work and there won't be. It's how we manage our society to share that work and to share remuneration. And what it comes down to is redistribution at the income end that enables people to live at whatever part of that they're in, which is why I've always been a supporter of the idea of basic income, which would take us out, and there's many versions of basic income or universal basic income, and there's quite dangerous, from where I sit politically, there's some very dangerous versions of it, because it can go right across the right-left political spectrum. So you get ACT people who also advocate for a BI. Right at the other end, from the groups I work with, we advocate a progressive basic income that is very redistributive, which you could see it as part of the tax system in one way, where everyone gets a basic income, just as those that are on superannuation get now. But your tax goes up once you start working, and just as one is taxed, if one's on super and you start to earn money. It's too complicated to explain here, but there are a growing number of people here and around the world who see a forms of basic income as a very liberating way forward out of the very brutal, punitive welfare system that we have at the moment. But I also believe just promoting basic income on its own is not enough, that we I'm very interested in the question of work and fair work, just work, what work means, and enabling people, all people who want to work, to have access to work and the honouring of all forms of work. And I think that needs to go alongside basic income, so it's not just seen as a bludger's charter or some, you know, this common thing, like it's just for lazy people who don't want to do their bit. It's not what basic income's about at all for me. It needs to go alongside the honouring and dignity of work, at decent wages if it's paid work. There's probably enough on that.
I mean, anyone else is welcome to comment on that. I mean, there is the.
My greatest concern is that work itself, the Protestant ethic, and the spirit of capitalism, you know, was all about hard work and Calvinism. It really underlined the importance of work. And my greatest concern is that work itself is being so devalued by the affluent, by kids who actually tell their parents, as I overheard, no, it's not about work, it's about making money. I don't have to work, I just need to make money. And when I heard that, I thought, oh my God, I've thrown away my whole life working hard. No, I haven't. Work is so important. It is so seriously important, and I gravely fear that we are generating a new generation that really doesn't value the hard work that, you know, you can think of the monastics, you know, tilling the garden, doing the most simple, important physical work. That is going to be a big challenge, I reckon.
Thanks, Rachel. You just said what I wanted to say about Sue, but this is, I think, it's such a fertile set of questions for us to think about. From my point of view, before I say what I really want to say, I want to say leisure is also part of the human DNA that's productive. After I say that, I want to say that work is a part of human DNA that is at the heart of creativity. And you help us think really clearly, Sue, about the importance of that.
Just hold on to that a moment, Hal, because a particular question to you. You gave us characteristics of progressive churches and then revisited them. So characteristics such as vulnerability and queerness, could they be considered values?
Yes. Whether that's the best category or not is not completely clear to me. I think I would probably, in your set of topics, I would probably tend towards meaning on that, but the complex relationship between values and meaning is in and of itself a wonderful topic.
So we'll move on to spirituality in various ways. Don't worry, Sue, we're not going to get there too quickly. We'll start with Lloyd. Lloyd, another thing that you said that sparked something off for me was a historical observation that religion began with feeling. So does spirituality belong to the heart or the head or ...
Well, it varies from person to person. Sometimes it's primarily the mind. For others, it is primarily the heart. But for me, spirituality has to do with the whole person, body, soul, and spirit. And that it's a dimension of human experience which we all know in our own experience, but which we find very difficult to describe to others. And that's why spirituality is a term that tends to defy definition for us.
I said earlier in the core group that if we went around asking what we meant by spirituality, we'd be there all day. We were 14 people in the group. But without staying here all day, would you like just to comment on the basic, where's the locus of spirituality?
Oh, gosh. Again, I would say the body, mind, and spirit, but it's very important to find ways to arouse that sense of spirituality. And therefore, I think that spirituality is, well, it's very helpful to have a religion which has thought long and hard about the spiritual life of individuals. And religions are, of course, structures, they are rituals, they are texts that reflect on spiritual dimensions of life. And sometimes God appears in many different guises, pointing to the different dimensions of the spiritual life. Therefore, I do see religion and spirituality as necessary partners, or at least co-creative partners, maybe not necessary, because you can have a spiritual experience, obviously, outside of religion. I've certainly heard about that as people go into the bush and climb mountains. And if you've seen the film Mountain, have any of you seen it? Extraordinary film. Wow, you must. Some of those people are clearly crazy. Others simply climb the mountains just to get there. But others surely do so because of that extraordinary spiritual experience that they have when they are on the journey and when they reach the peak. So, I mean, I think it's, as Lloyd said, it's a mind-body-spirit experience, but it's far deeper. It's far, far deeper. If you think about it, read about it, engage in practices that intentionally raise it up. Spirituality is not just something that happens upon you. It's a skill. Believe it or not, it is a skill. And like all good things, great things, it helps to have experience. It helps to know what you're doing, to be expectant, but not necessarily demanding. And that's why religion and spirituality have been seen together as partners, because they have worked together that way for millennia. And long may it continue.
I'm curious, Sue, would you like to answer to that?
Thank you. Well, I agree with Lloyd and Rachel. It is body and mind. I think it's really hard for people like me who had no faith or church upbringing background at all. It started from pure science and the rational approach to the world, and science as God, basically, which is how I was brought up by a geneticist. Genetics and biology are what we are, and of course I still acknowledge that, but to have a spirituality within that and to consciously keep looking for it as long as I can remember, looking for God or some meaning, but never finding an organised form of it that met some of those demands you raised. The intelligent, I loved hearing Lloyd when I was 17 because I thought you were right. But having listened to that still didn't leave me anywhere to go from totally outside, because every time I went in a church I could see all the things that were wrong with it or that I disagreed with, and I've been to many different types of church in my life, particularly investigated into Taoism and Buddhism as well, which I feel more at home with. But yeah, it's hard battering on that door from outside. So I think it's a great gift if you have, in a way, you people are responding to structures that you came from, even if you totally reject them and hate them, you've still got a background, just as all these Catholics, a lot of Catholics I've worked with, who totally reject Catholicism or reject the history of the church and the role, a lot of sisters, still some of whom are still sisters, but have rejected hugely the patriarchy and nature of the Catholic Church, but are finding a very liberated community now. And what they're doing, and I look at them and think, yeah, they're my sisters. They call me sisters. Like, we're sisters under the skin.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, you and I know you can't get much better in humanity than Catholic sisters. Something has happened in basically French-based social philosophy since the 1980s that helps me think about defining spirituality. And that's the shift from the spirit vocabulary to the word practice. And so there's a lot of thought about what are our practices. And for me, that allows some headway in that regard to say, so what are the longer-term things we do? And then I would say that help us maintain and make meaning. For me, that really important shift in thinking about definition. The second shift that I rely on is an ancient one. So the Greco-Romans, of whom the early Christ people are a part, they actually have an anthropology of spirit, which until I learned it, I thought one way. But the Greco-Roman frame of reference says that spirit is material. just thinner material. So in other words, if you think of the body, the Greco-Roman said, yes, spirit is a part of the body. It is bodily. It is material. It's just more fluid and less thick. So I've been very helped by thinking that, for instance, you're right, Rachel, religion and spirituality are so entwined. But inasmuch as our age sometimes wants to make a difference between religion and spirit, it's that spirit is more fluid and doesn't bump into a bunch of institutional problems. In the long run, you have to include practice as institutional as well.
So Lloyd reminded us of the dualism that came in, the body and soul dualism that came from the Greek world. So that's a nice corrective, that the thin clothing of spirit, and of course a very Hebrew idea that body, it's all in one. You might like to comment on that, Rachel, but the particular question I have for you is your program on ABC is the spirit of things. So a felicitous phrase. I just wondered, was it your phrase or where did it come from?
Yes, it certainly was my phrase. I had done a program called Religion Today, which I created, and I wanted it to morph into something that was deeper, that didn't have to address the news of the day. And I was standing on a street corner and looking at the lights. And I knew that one of the most well-known programs of one of my fellow Canadians, David Suzuki, was called The Nature of Things. And it suddenly struck me as I was standing there, well, there's the nature of things, but then there's the spirit of things. There's the spirit of what you do, of what occurs, of how we live, of who we are. And I walked into work and I said, the program is going to be called The Spirit of Things. And they all looked at me and said, you're going to talk about spirits? Or what is this? Is this spiritism? No, it isn't. And of course, I have made every single program now in its 20th year. David Suzuki has been a guest on that program at least twice. And you know, strangely enough, the world is so weird. When I was 16, the Czechs came from Czechoslovakia, the 68 spring. They fled to Canada. I met one. He instantly wanted to marry me. I said, no, sorry, Milan, we don't do that here. I have a big future ahead of me. You're very nice. Goodbye. Well, so many years later, guess what? He is David Suzuki's cameraman for every single program of The Nature of Things. And we met some years later, and he came to Australia with his then partner, because strangely enough, he married the sister. It's so weird. He married the woman who was the same age as my sister who we grew up with. I mean, very strange connections. But that has to be one of the strangest, that he ends up being on The Nature of Things and I the spirit of things. And we had no idea of where we had ended up. So that's where the program got that name.
So we dig deep into the personal things. But yeah. If you want to use the title, it's The Spirit of Things, copyright, Rachel Cohen.
That's right.
Royalties in this direction. We'll move on to meaning, which is one of those byline words. And turn to Lloyd, particularly Lloyd, you, being the guardian of Sea of Faith culture, or the originator of Sea of Faith culture in this country. So this is just setting you up here. So I think it's a question of meaning. Our discussions are often around meaning. Things that really matter go to the heart of things, but then we come to the end of a conference and we want to do something. So I'm afraid this is an old chestnut again, but it was raised by someone. Can Sea of Faith be both a talk fest and activist? Or is there any middle way? Is there any, after we've done our digging down into meaning, where... As a body, is there any response for Sea of Faith members?
Well, individuals, there is. As we go from a meeting like this, which, if it's been of any real value to us, has reshaped us. We go away from a conference like this slightly different from the persons who came here. And what we carry with us is what we've learned from. And so, in a sense, what we've learned about the meaning of life and the meaning of our lives in a gathering like this, we take away and hopefully put into action of some kind.
Thank you. It's been raised before, so I'm saying that for the benefit particularly of Lou and Hal. And the question in this case contained its own answer. It made a suggestion that the conference has ended and people feel strongly about something. So someone writes the letter to the government minister or whatever, and it appears in Sea of Faith newsletter as well. And then that same theme can be amplified by individuals. But there's a sense of movement by sharing that concern. And I just wonder, it's a perfectly sensible idea, but is letter writing actually activism? Sue.
Of course it is. It's one of many, many forms of activism. There are many different ways we can try and create change. But I just warn about things like letters and petitions to Parliament, to MPs, because I've been 10 years on the other side of that. I just thought I'd bring that experience here for a moment, that petitions, while they have worthy and very, I mean, there's always a purpose in them, but you know what happens to those petitions when they hit the Parliamentary Select Committee? There's 1,275 signatures, there's four signatures, it doesn't matter, that petition just goes into a box. The committee usually just acknowledges it pro forma, unless there's a really big campaign working alongside that petition in all sorts of other ways, it just dies there and then. There is no obligation on Parliament to pay any attention to it. With letters, the MP or Cabinet Minister will usually have a secretary or executive assistant who will reply to your letter very politely. If they're a good MP, they'll reply. Whether anything ever changes as a result of that is another issue, which is why there's no time to run a workshop on effective lobbying for change. There are many, many tools that also need to be used. But I would never want to, in the same, or letters to the paper, quite old-fashioned these days, but still useful. I'd never say it's not worth writing letters, but it's a very low-level form, and I think ideally would be attached to other collective advocacy.
So do others have ideas about how Sea of Faith, probably individual members, can take action in support of the causes that we're stirred by coming here?
Just like to be more positive for a minute, because some of you are part of action groups and activist groups, I'm sure. I've heard of a few of them around in this room, and that working with others is always the message that I try and get across, the importance of not being alone, about working with others to forward whatever it is that you want to change. One of the most effective things, I think, in New Zealand democracy is the Parliamentary Select Committee. And I know some of you, because you've told me, have been part of making submissions. That is amazing when you both write a submission and come and speak to it. Even if it's only a one person, much less a group, who's made that submission, the MPs do listen. And because we have an MMP Parliament these days, it's much more democratic than when we had first past the post. So if you're really passionate and there's a legislation in front of the House, I'd really encourage, among many other tools, using that one. And good on you for those that have already done it or are doing it.
Thank you, Sue.
The idea that the Sea of Faith should do something is, I think, irrelevant. But Sea of Faith members should. And I once said to a church meeting that every member of the church should be a member of a political party. And I've been a card-paying member of the Green Party from its inception. And I think everybody else should. And that's the way in which, in your particular party, you bring the concerns you have, and the party considers them, they're worthwhile, then they take them further. That's the way in which we can all be active participants of a democracy.
I think both Sue and Lloyd could have a bit of a tennis match about that one and the value of political parties. But well, staying with meaning, but this is going to be for you, Hal. It's a bit of a sort of backhanded way of looking at meaning. It comes from something that Sue said after her talk in response to the questions, that she was not an ist, not a social ist or any other kind of ist. And having got to know you a bit, Hal, I sense that you're not an ist either, but that you would take each document, each person, each religious movement on their merits. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that, the isms and the ists that Sue avoids. What about you?
Oh, that's too hard a question. I don't think that I am resistant to being an ist. And when I think about my history, sometimes I have been, and sometimes I haven't. Just thinking about the larger category of meaning, I would like to make that a verb rather than a noun. And I've tried to make it meaning-ning. That never really made sense. So I'd like to talk about meaning-making rather than just meaning, to put it into verbal frame so that that acknowledges the stages and complexities of where we are. But I would want to say that meaning-making isn't the task simply of an individual to make meaning, but rather meaning-making itself happens on multiple levels all the time, whether we want it to or not. And so when I think of meaning-making, it is sometimes deeply individual, but often deeply collective. And I would want to say then deeply a part of the larger earth as well. We don't make meaning unless we're always interaction with the earth itself, with other people and other social bodies. Getting back to your question, I think that in some cases when we're deeply a part of social bodies, which I think I am regularly, that tends to be an ist. And if it makes itself the only way of meaning making, then I discard it. Often I think it is just a really important value. And so, no, I think I'm an ist now and then.
Maybe coming out of your something you said towards the end of your talk, younger people will not pigeonhole themselves in one place. So it's all right to be an ist as long as you've got other ists alongside it and it's a fluid matter.
Oh, I've had my times in which I've felt healthy in just one ist. But I as I talk to my younger conversation partners, that's mostly about fear and I would want to say really good fear. That is, I think that our younger constituents have been betrayed in so many ways by the larger processes that them wanting to avoid investment socially over long terms is simply seeing how that didn't work out a lot.
Rachel, we're still on meaning, and I think we value your presence. I said it to you, you're a Sea of Faith regular now because you've been three times. Lloyd is obviously a Sea of Faith super regular. So we value what you bring for yourself, but for an authentic Jewishness as well, which is an aspect which we don't always have immediate access to. So what struck me in your talk was what you quoted about no one can be said to hear the voice of God, hear the authoritative voice of God. That you cannot say, God told me this. And I think that could be a very valuable perspective in our time. So to developing that, there can only be an interpretation. There could be no final answer was the way you developed that. So I'm wondering whether you would agree that Jewish concept can have a more universal application and is perhaps what we need today.
Well, thank you. That's quite an honor. I must also say that particular ruling was in respect to rabbis not being able to agree. You could not pull out of your hat, I have the final ruling, God told me it's this. So that was the context. You could not have the final answer because you claim that God told you. Maybe it is the fact that I am Jewish, that I have done this program for so long and that I am the only one in the religious studies department that has the kinds of expertise and many degrees in 4 or 5 degrees in religious studies. I think when I came into the department, the first thing I saw was the rivalries, the hatreds, the bitter suspicions they each had because they all were there representing a particular denomination of the Christian faith. And I felt that they were so locked in to their versions of truth. They could not see each other for what they were, and they certainly could not see outside into the larger world. I think that as a Jewish person who comes from a tradition that has always maintained that everyone can see God, that you do not have to be Jewish to be saved or to be righteous. We don't use the word saved. You do not have to be Jewish to be righteous. And that is a deep down ancient position in the Jewish faith. And that basically freed me very early on to be interested in Christianity, in Buddhism, in Hinduism. I have an MA in New Testament as well as rabbinic studies. And that has been, and also a PhD in a Jewish Christian, in the history of Jews and Christians and their relationships in the early modern to modern period, and then others. Chinese Buddhism, very, very significant development of Buddhism, unique in its ability to evolve these beautiful schools within the Chan or Zen tradition, which are just so extraordinary, poetically, philosophically, humanly. They are each and every school, how they related to each other and how they articulated the truth by using the metaphor of the pearl. These are things we can learn. I could see immediately some connections to the Jewish tradition. And you know what? It turned out it wasn't accidental, because there were connections. There were historical meetings between traditions. Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, most especially as well. So much goes on in the sea of faith across the centuries. Don't give up that name. It is a beautiful name, because within the sea there are many currents, many fish, many... It's the lifeblood of this planet. Without the seas, you know, the planet would shrivel up and die. I think it is a beautiful term. And I think that quietly, I've never championed this, I've never proclaimed it on air, but I do think that the Jewish faith has allowed me a perspective and an insight, unthreatened. I'm never threatened. People ask me, oh, you do all this. Well, you know, what are you now? Are you still Jewish? I mean, can you be Jewish? You know, when you're exploring this or that, of course you can be. Why wouldn't you be? It's a strange question to me, because you can have passionate insight and knowledge of the other and not be threatened by it. You can be deepened, widened, excited, but these are not either-or situations. And once you find yourself in that either-or, then something's wrong. Something is definitely wrong. And I've always been kind of open to sensing that as well. So I think I just happened to be the right person to be recruited at that time.
Thank you, Rachel. You use the phrase "see a faith" very naturally in responding there. Probably I have to say this, but I think it needs saying each time. It comes from a poem, a Matthew Arnold poem, and the way in which it's used is it's with a sense of regret. It's the sea of faith that was once around the world and it's withdrawing. So that's the context. And
it's rising.
Yeah. So maybe we see a faith member not only to write a letter to the minister, but to put another verse to the poem that talks about the sea of faith rising. Okay, so we haven't lost it yet. Sea of faith. Values, spirituality, meaning. A couple of kind of wrap-up questions, which, again, to everyone. There's one that is specifically from
haven't credited other people, but Alan Jackson, your moment of glory. This is your question. Ignoring Luther's anti-Semitism, his, you know, his anti-Jewish vitriol, but ignoring that, would Luther approve of any part of the Protestant Church now? I think this is a question for you, Lloyd.
That's not an easy question to answer, because each of us lives in a cultural context of our time and reflect that in with thinking. And it's when you take Martin Luther out of the early 16th century and put him into the 21st century, it's very hard to think what he would think. So hopefully he would be a person who was able to stretch his mind and see that what he had started and and was unaware of where it was going to lead to, that he would hopefully see that this was the logical conclusion, as I've said, to what he actually started. So hopefully I would answer yes, he would.
I want to widen the question as I pass the microphone further down and just give a little preface to it. In the CFA committee meets in February for a full day and then has monthly meetings, and there's an amount of talk which is outside of the immediate Sea of Faith sphere. And book recommendations come up from time to time. And the books that have been recommended constantly to me by Sea of Faith members are the two books by Yuval Noah Harari, Sapiens, which is a history of humankind, the last 100,000 years. But then there's a second book called Homo Deus, and that is simply a brief history of tomorrow, taking the ideas, learning what we can from humankind over the last 100,000 years. Can we learn from that and look into the future? And he admits how difficult that is. How far ahead can you look? A brief history of the next 100 years, not a hope. 50 years, you'd be doing extremely well. So let's reduce it to 5 years. What will the state of religion be in 5 years? Or if you're really brave, 50 years. Big question. Big pause.
Well, I'll let Hal have the last word, or Lloyd. I don't think a lot will change, but I hope some will change. I hope to see braver Muslim women, because the ones who have been bravely trying to reshape their tradition to something more equitable and more friendly to women and children, and reflecting some of our, yes, Western egalitarianism and human rights, have done so with bodyguards around them. When I interviewed Ayan Hirsi Ali at the Sydney Theatre a few years ago, we walked up to the theatre and I saw that a booth right in front of it had been incinerated. And that was a sign. It was a warning. And as we sat on the dais in the theater, she was the one wired up with security, but I wasn't. And I was sitting there thinking, this is probably the most dangerous interview I've ever done. And that is a very, very sad state of affairs. Women who have tried to lead prayer meetings in New York, at St. John of the Cross, in the cathedral there, have been warned off with bomb warnings and bomb threats, I mean. These are the things that Muslim women are facing. In Australia, as I said, they won't even put their head above the parapet. We need to hope that that will change, because until that changes, some of the quality of our life will not change, because at the moment we are frightened. In Australia, we really are. We have lots and lots of terror plots revealed every day. We have one of the highest levels of young men joining ISIS. It's very serious, and it's not paranoid, and it's not Islamophobic, because I know Australians are not Islamophobic. We really aren't, even though I'm a Canadian Australian, have been there for 30 years. I know the way Aussies are. And we need to have that change, and I hope that it does. That's on the top of my list, actually. I've probably said enough.
I won't talk about the future of the church or churches, but just you made me think there about the role. I've always really appreciated what I think of as really good science fiction or speculative fiction is one route of creatively, people who've really deeply creatively imagined the future, and I think that I find that really helpful in trying to conceive of a world beyond what we have now. They've done, and I think of Margaret Atwood, of course, but also I don't know how many people here read Kim Stanley Robinson, who has a science background and has really gone into the futures of climate change and resource depletion, and just amazing books by Kim Stanley Robinson, but also one in the Years of Rice and Salt, which goes back and thinks about what if the interaction between Muslim and Christian had been very different back, I think, around the 12th century. So just if anyone's interested in that kind of route, because I think, yeah, the artists who take us forward are a very good lens for us to think of how we can make the world better now.
Thank you for broadening that. Yep. Thank
you. Just a preface about how I see religion itself. I see religion itself as a deep yet flawed and important social human intelligence. In other words, I think it's a way that we think collectively and that is often very valuable, but occasionally not. So the future, I'll pick 30 years in two frames. Worldwide religion will be increasingly violent, will be entangled in wars. I don't think that's an end, but I think it is a clear two generations of devastating violence being generated by living within religion. For my own country, so I would want to, just because you ask, I'll say 30 years out, Christianity in the United States. It will continue to decline, not quite on the models of Europe, but perhaps somewhat similarly. Christianity's evangelicalism has already stopped growing about 15 years ago. That's very clear. It's in retreat in very similar ways to the rest of most churches. It, however, will be much more politically powerful in the next decade than its numbers indicate. The kind of Christianity that I'm interested in, I think the model there is monasticism. Not that we will be monastics, but monasticism in the Middle Ages was the place where those who were rigorous intellects and rigorous in their spiritual practice got a chance to be small but productive. So I think that if there is such a thing as progressive Christianity or something like that in the next 30 years, it will continue to be monumentally productive intellectually and spiritually, but not strong numerically.
Thank you, Lloyd. Perhaps a last word, same question, but presumably in Aotearoa, would you care to say what will be the state of religion in 5 years' time, 50 years' time, if you dare?
New Zealand is actually one of the most secular countries in the world, partly because it was founded at the age when the emphasis in secular and secularism was at its height. And that is why our Education Act said that education had to be secular. It illustrates the reason why New Zealand has become so secular. And the traditional religion, the traditional forms of religion in the mainline churches are dying at a very fast rate. Charismatic religion, on the contrary, is growing. Whether it will grow sufficiently to take the place of the denominational religions is very hard to say. I doubt that it will, because it depends far too much upon emotion and not upon reason. And for this reason, I would have to say that there is a spiritual vacuum emerging in New Zealand society. Now, that's a very dangerous situation, because indeed Jesus had a parable about it. In casting out a devil, 100 more devils take its place. And that is what's likely to happen spiritually in New Zealand too. All sorts of irrational kind of movements could possibly arise. And keeping ourselves reasonably rational and secular is not going to be as easy as we had hoped for in the past. So although I won't be here, of course, to see all this, and any kind of suggestion that comes from me is more of a guess. Nevertheless, that's how I see it. The charismatic groups in New Zealand are already stronger than the rest of the denominations put together in activity. But I'm not sure that they will continue to grow in that way, because they tend to be on the margin of public interest. They take little interest in what goes on in society. They're concerned with themselves and their own spirituality. They are inward looking in the way in which the churches used to be outward looking. That's illustrated by the fact that someone here just pointed out to me recently, the Presbyterian Church, when its heyday, had a strong public questions committee in which it used to make statements of importance that the government of the day took some notice of. The church has no public questions committee at all today. The Presbyterian Church just lives, and its main purpose in life is to try and survive. and it won't survive more than another 40 years, because most people in it active are in their 60s, 70s, 80s. And as I said, this illustrates there's going to be a kind of spiritual vacuum in society, and Jesus had a parable that is the answer to that.
Well, thank you for throwing in the prediction of 40 years. I think you're very generous to the Presbyterian Church. I'd like to thank all the panel, particularly the newcomers, for picking up the dynamic of Seer Faith conferences and generously using your time and moving amongst us. I know people here really value the in-between conversations, so thank you for doing that. And thank you, obviously, for being here to the end to share together on this panel. I'm sure people will show their applause.